I wanted to, this evening, I wanted to look at Perek Dalet and Perek Hey, as we move into a new chapter 4 and chapter 5, as we move into a new section of the Book of Kings. We finished basically establishing the bona fides of Solomon as the next king. Shlomo HaMelech has been established. All of the political enemies that David outlined who could threaten the stability of the throne in the future have been eliminated. Yoav, Shim'i, and the priests who were problematic were exiled and basically neutralized outside of the power base of Jerusalem. In chapter 3 last week, we learned about Solomon's asking transference of the worship, the area of worship from Gibeon in the territory of Binyamin to Jerusalem. The great Mizbeach has now been transferred to where the ark was brought by David. So it's just a short while before we actually will begin the major project of Solomon's life, which is the building of the temple. And the transference of the altar, the place of worship of God, from Gibeon to Yerushalayim is basically the first stage, the first opening shot where Solomon is conveying the message that the future lies in Jerusalem, not only as a political capital, but also as the spiritual capital, that it's going to fuse the ark and the presence of God together with the service of God. The second half of chapter 3, which we saw last week, was, of course, as part of that transfer, God appeared to Solomon in a revelation and asked him, what do you want to be an effective king? And Solomon asked for wisdom, and the famous story of the two prostitutes, which proves that. But there we saw the chokhmah, we saw the wisdom of Solomon in a very specific light, in a judicial light. We're going to see in the next couple of chapters not only Solomon's wisdom as expressed in judicial acumen, but also Solomon's wisdom as expressed in organizational acumen, in secular knowledge, and in other areas of life. So when God said to him he would give him chokhmah, binah, and daat, that God would give him that, it ranges not only in the limited area, which is important, of vishafteinu malkeinu. Remember, I showed you last week, when the people in the book of Samuel asked for a king, they asked, one of the major things they asked for was a king who would, quote unquote, judge us, shofteinu, that Solomon has ticked off. But we're going to see that the chokhmah of Solomon goes beyond that in tonight's perek, as well as in subsequent perek, so subsequent chapters. So let's begin with chapter 4. The text tells us that, if we remember, look at the end of chapter 3 in verse 28. We have an interesting term. Again, very internal. Vayishme'u kol Yisrael et ha-mishpat asher shafat Shlomo. Vayiru mipnei ha-melech ki ra'u ki chokhmat Elohim bekirbo lasut mishpat. Vayhi ha-melech Shlomo melech al kol Yisrael. When you look at that verse, which is printed as the first verse of chapter 3, could also be the last verse of chapter... It's printed in many Tanakhim as the first verse of chapter 4 is also really the last verse of chapter 3. And again, the key word there is Kol Yisrael. Vayishme'u Kol Yisrael, verse 28 in chapter 3. And then in verse 1 of chapter 4, Vayhi HaMelech Shlomo Melech Al Kol Yisrael, on the totality of Israel, which again highlights, again, something that we spoke about the very first year, that one of the unique aspects of monarchy, as opposed to a shofet, is the pan-national aspect of his rule. It is not necessarily a rule of tribal, but it emphasizes the Kol Yisrael. The entirety of Israel is under the thumb and the rule of this king. And so the repetition, Vayishme'u Kol Yisrael, all of Israel heard it. Vayhi ha-melech, Shlomo melech, al kol Yisrael, all of Israel. But also, again, the focus is very much pnimi. It's very much internal. We continue with that in the next two sections. In chapter 4, the Bible discusses the bureaucracy, the governmental organization that King Solomon set up. Now, to understand the importance of it, we have to go back for a second. If you go back in your Tanakh, if you go back to the book of Samuel, you go back to Shmuel, Bet. Samuel 2, chapter 8. Shmuel Bet, Perek Chet, chapter 8 in the book of Samuel. You'll see a very interesting thing. When we compare the governmental structure of previous kings to Solomon, we see the slow evolution from a very, very simple political system to a very complex bureaucracy. So, like, for example, when we think about King Saul, okay? When we think about King Saul, so King Saul, we know nothing of his political organization because he had no political organization. All he had was a chief of staff, Avner ben Ner. He's the only one who we know has an official title, Sar Tzava. He is the minister of war. He's the only one who's identified. We don't know if there was a sanitation minister. We don't know if there was an economic minister. Because truth be told, the only thing we're told about King Saul is his battles with the Philistines, his battles with Amalek, his battles with Nachash ben Ammon, and his internal battles of chasing David. We know nothing about, did King Saul build roads? Did King Saul build palaces? Did King Saul tax the people? Nothing. We don't know anything about King Saul. David, in chapter 8 of Shmuel Bet, chapter 8, verse 16, the Bible tells us, for the first time, after, and this is, so to speak, at his pinnacle of power, so the Bible tells us, in chapter 8 of Shmuel Bet, Perek Tedva, Pasuk Tedva, Vayimloch David al Kol Yisrael, same language. David was king over all of Israel. Vayhi David osem mishpatot tzedakah l'chlomo. David was doing justice. V'Yoav ben Tzruel hatzava. Yoav was the minister of war. V'Yoshafat mazkir, ben Achilud mazkir. He had a mazkir, a secretary, somebody who kind of, I guess, was the chief of staff. V'tzadok ben Achituv, Achimelech ben Yavtar Kohanim, Usraya Sofer, Ubnayahu ben Yoyada, V'akreti V'apleiti, Ubnei David Kohanim Hayu. So it's a very, very limited government in terms of the top ministers. We don't see any taxation. We don't see any building projects. We don't know anything about what David did. The only thing that we know from the book of Chronicles is that towards the end of his life, David started collecting building materials to build to allow his son Solomon to be able to start and be able to build the temple right away. So that's what we see in chapter 8. Towards the end of David's life, after he's returned to Jerusalem and the battle with Avshalom. So if you turn to chapter 20, after the restoration of David as king, chapter 20 in Shmuel Bet, Perek Chaf, Pasuk, Chaf Gimel, after he's returned to Jerusalem. So the Bible says, V'yoav, chapter 20, verse 23, V'yoav, El Kolat Sava Yisrael, Yoav was still the Sar Tzava, he was still the minister of war. U'benayahu ben Yoyada l'kreti v'apleiti, notice that the kreti and the pleiti have been moved up. If in chapter 8, the Kreti and the Pleiti were at the end of the list, here they've been moved up, probably because the Kreti and the Pleiti, according to most commentaries, on a pshat level, I'm not talking about a midrashic level, they were what we would call today the palace guard. They were the people who protected the king and his most family. And so notice that after the struggles with Shimei and the struggles with Avshalom and all that, they've been elevated. The idea of protecting the king and the king's family at all costs have been elevated. Then it's Adoram al-Hamas. For the first time, we have the word Mas. We have a minister of taxation. Obviously, David has started to build roads or build things or to collect stuff for Solomon. V'yoshafat hamazkir. Once again, you have a secretary, a chief of staff. V'sraya usva sofer. V'tzadok kohanim. V'gam irayariya ya kohen l'david. So notice, again, yeah, the secret service. That's a good way to translate kreitu pleiti. And notice the organization. So we still have the Sar Tzava, number one. Then we have the palace guard, the secret service. And then we have the introduction of a bigger bureaucracy. We come now to our chapter when we start to learn Malachim. So you'll notice, as everybody points out, Solomon has this very elaborate cabinet. Chapter 4, verse 2. Back to Kings, Kings 1, chapter 4. Malachim Aleph Perek Dalet. Ve'ela Sarim Ashalo, Azaryahu ben Tzadok HaKohen. Notice the first one mentioned is not the Sar Tzava. It's not the military. It's the Kohanim, which again is a foreshadowing, number one, of two things. Number one, in the entire book of Kings, we have no evidence that Solomon ever had to fight any wars. Maybe they were, since David had been so successful in expanding the empire, by the time Solomon came along, he probably related Kretu Pleiti to the Urim V'Tumim, because there's another Sefer called the Urim V'Tumim on Shulchan Aruch. So here, notice, the first person mentioned is the Kohen. Then it's Elichoref V'Achia Ben Shasofrim, the people who recorded the minutes. Then Yehoshaphat Hamazkir, the chief of staff. Then Benayahu Ben Yoyadal Atzava. Then Benayahu, who's on the Tzava. V'Tzadok V'Evyatar Kohanim. So again, it's a very different order, very different pecking order, which reflects the foreshadowing of the Kohanim. And the centrality of the temple is going to play a much bigger role than the Tzava, than the military. The military has been bumped down in terms of its significance. And it ends off with a whole slew of new bureaucracy, cabinet posts, like what's going on in Israel, where, you know, in order to get everybody in the coalition, they have to give out more and more ministerial posts. V'Azariah ben Natan al Nitzavim, we'll see what that is. Azariah was in charge of the Nitzavim. V'Zavud ben Natan Kohen Re'e HaMelech, the advisor to the king. V'Achishar al Habayit, Achishar was in charge of the house. Does that refer to the house of Solomon? Because it, as we'll see, it's a very elaborate affair. And so he needs a minister to take care of all of the affairs of the house. And Adoniram ben Avidal Hamas. Adoniram is in charge of the taxation. So this is what we have here at the beginning. We then have a second level of bureaucracy. This is what we would call the level of bureaucracy centralized in Jerusalem. But there's also a decentralized bureaucracy, because for the first time, Solomon introduces into the discussion the following. He sets up regions. That's the next section, verse 7 through the end of the chapter. We have a list of the regions, 12 regions. V'lishlomo shneim asar nitzavim al kol Yisrael. He divided Israel into 12 regions. V'chilkilu et hamelech ve'et beito chodesh v'ashana ye'al echad l'chalkel. Basically, each region of the, and you can look at the details of how he split up the regions, but what's interesting is each one of those regions was responsible for providing the provisions for the palace and its environs and everybody else who worked in the palace and the government for a month. They had to do that. And the Bible tells us exactly who they were. What's interesting is that it tells us the regions and the division of the regions. And of course, it's very tantalizing, because when Solomon introduces 12 regions, you would think, oh, 12, 12 is the Shvatim, 12 is the tribes. But there's no tribes here. It's not divided. Again, I don't want to go into the picayune details of exactly where and where each region was, but it's very clear that the regions do not correspond to exactly what we call the tribal divisions that we found in the book of Joshua and we find in the book of Shoftim. It doesn't do that. It divides Israel into different kinds of organizations, not the normal classical tribal affiliations. And so why does Solomon do that? The Nitzavim, the governors, there's 12 governors, and each of them are responsible for a region. And one of the things that the region has to do is provide once a year for a month, you know, from their fields and cattle, the provisions for the central government in Jerusalem. So the question is, why does Solomon do that? So there's basically two approaches in the scholarship today. The Mefarshim don't talk so much about it, the classical Mefarshim, but in the scholarship, there's basically two approaches. Approach number one is, well, remember that the tribal divisions from the time of Solomon, from the time of Joshua and the time of the Shoftim are no longer accurate. What I mean by they're no longer accurate, because remember, during the time of David, there was a lot of conquest. There were a lot of battles that are described in the book of Shmuel. Chapter 7, 8, 9, 10. And even when you get to the Bathsheba story, in the end, they win against Bathsheba. They win against Aram in that battle in which Uriah is murdered. But so there was an expansion of the land. So that it was no longer feasible to simply remain with the tribal affiliations. And rather, there was a need for a new division of the land that had been annexed, if you want to say, into the empire of David. That's one approach. The second approach is a little bit even more, I think, deep politically. A number of modern writers have said that what Solomon really wanted to do was to undermine the whole tribal notion of the Jewish people. Now that we have a king, and part of being a king is to unify the people, we're no longer going to have this identity of regions or this identity of tribes. We are going to have 12 regions that are equal, and we're going to have a totally different organizational principle where the central government is the focus of attention. It's very much like, you know, what the Soviet Union wanted to do when it created the Soviet Union and kind of, you know, eliminate the local, you know, nationalisms in all these various regions and countries that they gobbled up. And in the end, you know, it doesn't work. Like we see with the fall of the Soviet Union, one of the greatest things that happened, or one of the most immediate things that happened, is that all this nationalism that was underneath the surface came bubbling up. The same thing, this attempt to crush tribal allegiances was not very successful. The North and the South immediately split after the death of Solomon, and the regional sense was never lost, but he may have been trying to do that. So that's a second approach in the scholarship about this. Yes, Debbie writes, articles of confederation versus a constitution. Correct. Very good. Okay, now, in this context, we now are ready to start chapter 5. Again, these are very quick chapters. So chapter 5, or chapter 4, ends with this very idyllic picture, or one might think it's idyllic, but it says that Yehuda, v'Yisrael rabim kachol asher al hayam, which has echoes of Genesis. They were so numerous as the sand on the shore. Ochlim v'shotim usmechim. You have this idyllic picture that everybody is... Sorry. Okay, I was just told that the building is going to close in about 20 minutes, so let me make it quick, okay, because I'm going to be kicked out here of SAR. So if you look at Yehuda Yisrael Rabim Kachol Asher Al-Yam L'Rov Ochlim V'Shotim U'Smechim, they're happy, they're eating. Everybody, it's like, you know, it's the 90s before the crash. It's the bubble. Everybody's making tons of money. Everybody's happy. Everybody's great. Ushlomo ya moshel. And Shlomo, notice the Bible's description. Now we move from the internal description of chapter 3 and 4 about the internal organization and status of Solomon, who was beloved or recognized by all of Israel. All of a sudden, we get a picture of the foreign policy. Ushlomo hayam moshel b'cholam amlachot. He controlled all of the small little city-states, kingdoms, mina nahar, eretz plishtim, v'ad gvul Mitzrayim, from the nahar, which is probably Euphrates, all the way down to Mitzrayim, magishim mincha, and they would bring tribute, v'ovdim et Shlomo kol yimei chayav, and they would serve Solomon. That term is a key term, put it in your back pocket, ovdim, they are serving, they are servants, very interesting term. It reminds us, you know, everybody is under the thumb of Solomon. They are the servants of Solomon. And now the Bible describes why it is that we need all of these 12 regions. In verse 2, Vayhi lechem Shlomo. Le'yom echad shloshim. Again, this is this long list from verse 2 through verse 5 of the amount of food that was necessary to sustain the bureaucracy and the central government, tremendous amount of food. But it's interesting, it uses a very interesting word here. In verse 4, Ki hu rodeh b'chol eiver hanahar. Why did they have so much need for such a big bureaucracy? Because they had an empire to run. Ki hu rodeh, and a very interesting, it's a very rare term in Tanakh. Ki hu rodeh, because he was rodeh, because he was in charge, and he was a rodeh, he was a tyrant over all of this territory. But there was peace around him. In verse 5, Vayeshev Yehuda v'Yisrael lavetach. And Judah and Israel were lavetach. They lived in peace. Ish tachat gafno, this is where the phrase comes from. Every man under his vine tree. And every man under his fig tree. Midan v'ad Beersheva kol yimei Shlomo. Now the phrase Yehuda v'Yisrael lavetach is taken directly from, it's right, redu, conquering and being, you know, subservient. The first redu, I'm sorry, the verse lavetach with total to be security reminds us, if you turn to the book of Vayikra, if you turn to the book of Leviticus and you turn to the great promise of Leviticus of chapter 25, verse 18, the Bible says in Leviticus, in Vayikra, Perek Chaf Eid, Pasuk Yilchet, Vasitem et chukotai v'nishpatai tishmor, Vasitem otam v'yishavtem ha'aretz labetach. You will live on the land in security. V'natna ha'aretz piryah v'achaltem lasov v'yishavtem labetach aleah. And then it's repeated in chapter 26, which is what we call Parshat Bechukotai. In Bechukotai, chapter 26, verse 3. In Bechukotai teleich v'misvatai. V'natati kishmechem b'itam. Everything will be great. V'shavtem labetach. V'natati shalom ba'aretz. U'shavtem v'ein macharim. And you'll live without fear. But what's interesting is what's going to happen at the end. The Bible says in verse 11. V'natati mishkeni b'tochem, v'lo tig'al nafshiyetchem, v'italachti b'tochem, v'hitei l'chem Elohim. God says, I will put my dwelling place amongst you. So the precursor for the building of the Mishkan in Eretz Yisrael, which we call the Mikdash, is the precursor to building the place of God, the place where God will dwell, is this peace and economic, bounty, which is exactly what's being described here at the beginning of chapter 5. Beginning of chapter 5, we have this description of everything is basically in a place where this can now be fulfilled. Once again, as the Bible tells us about the greatness of Solomon, it also is subversive and it undermines Solomon. Because what happens in the very next verse, in verse 6? Vayhi l'Shlomo arba'im elef urot susim l'merkavo, u'shnayim asar elef parashim. V'chilkilu anitzavim eilet ha'melech Shlomo v'et kol ha'kariv l'shulchan ha'melech ish chodsho lo yadudor. All of a sudden, we're told this interesting little detail about how much the horses had to eat because he had so many horses. Now, you don't have to be a great Tanakh scholar to remember that one of the injunctions about the danger that a king has is lo yarbelo susim, that he should not have too many horses, lest he go back to Egypt. Egypt represents the reversal of Jewish history. We left Egypt. We don't go back to Egypt, even to get horses. To get horses means to be reliant on Egypt rather than reliant on God. That's exactly what he's doing. So at the same time that Solomon is setting us up for the building of the temple, a fulfillment of the bracha, of the great blessing articulated at the beginning of Parshat Bechukotai, he's already planting the seeds of his own demise. He married Bat Paro, that we saw at the beginning of last week's chapter. He's got all these horses and all these horsemen and all these chariots that have to be taken care of and fed. That's already a problem. So in the very act of doing great things, he's also undermining himself. The next section, as I said before, expands the notion of the Chochmah of Shlomo. The Chochmah of Shlomo, and here the Bible uses the word Chochmah 7 times between verse 9 and verse 14. Vayitein, verse 9, Elohim Chochmah l'Shlomo, 1. Vateirev Chochmat Shlomo mechochmat kol b'nei kedem, 2-3. Umikol Chochmat Mitzrayim, 4. Vayechkam mikol adam, 5. And he spoke these things. And the Bible tells us he spoke to the animals, he spoke to the trees. And Vayavo Yikol Amin, verse 14, Lishmoet Chochmat Shlomo, number 6, Asher Shamu et Chochmato. This is a parallel to chapter 3. Chapter 3 ended with the phrase, Vayishmu'u Kol Yisrael et HaMishpat. The people heard, Israel heard about the Mishpat and the wisdom. And it says, Vayir'u Mipnei HaMelech Ki Ra'u Ki Chochmat Elohim B'Kirbo. So chapter 3 ends with the people of Israel seeing and hearing the Chochmat Shlomo in a very narrow context of judicial adjudication. And now we have the fact that the whole world, not the whole world, but the world in which they lived, in the Middle East and in the Mesopotamia and in Egypt, they all heard about Chochmat Shlomo, which extended beyond judicial decisions, also extended to what we would call the natural sciences, botany, zoology, and the ability to organize a camp and a government. And the Bible says, at this point, in verse 15, we have the story of Solomon, reaches out to the king of Tyre. Tyre is today called Tsor, is in Lebanon. In the time of Solomon, Tyre was not part of Lebanon. It was an island off the coast of Lebanon. It was filled in later in history, and connected to the landmass of, you know, like if you've ever been to the South Street Seaport. Originally, that wasn't part of Manhattan. It was filled up and then connected. So Tyre eventually becomes connected to Lebanon much later in history. And Hiram is a king who we know from the book of Divrei Hayamim, from Chronicles, made already in the time of David, made alliances with David. And one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is, why did Lebanon or Tyre, which was on the coast of Lebanon, why was it important for them to make an alliance with David already? And then, of course, it's strengthened here with Solomon, which we'll talk about more next week. And one of the major reasons is we have to start understanding a little bit of the geopolitical reality at the time. At this time, there are two major powers in the Middle East. There is Mitzrayim, which Solomon has entered into nuptials with. But there's also Aram. Babel is not yet a major power. Assyria is not a major power in the 950s BCE when Solomon. But the major power of the north is called Aram. Okay, Aram, the Arameans. They are the biggest threat in the book of Kings. If in the book of Samuel, the biggest threat are the Philistines, and you become king and you become the anointed one of God by destroying the Philistines, that has to be on your CV in order to be a good king and fulfill your destiny. That's who they're afraid of. By the time we get to the end, David and Solomon, the Philistines are no longer a factor in the book of Kings in any way, shape, or form, but the Arameans up north in today what we would call Syria and Turkey and parts of Turkey, they are the major northern power. And it probably the Lebanese, the Phoenicians, and Sor start to see them as the bigger threat and want to make alliances with the smaller powers, which are not so small anymore, like David and Solomon, as a bulwark against the Arameans. Okay, as you see, it's gotten darker in here. They're about to close the building here. So unfortunately, I have to close up because I can't teach from the street. So we will continue Amir Tzashem next week, and we will maybe we'll add a few minutes to the shir, and we'll finish up chapter 5 and begin the actual building of the temple. I wish everybody a good evening. I hope that when I get home, I have power in my house. But otherwise, I'm coming over to Avrami's.
That's okay. Please.
Okay. All the best. Good evening, everybody.
Rabbi Helfgott, one question.
Yeah.
Why does it mention Yehuda v'Yisrael if he's trying to combine?
Because it's again telling us, just like with the Soviet Union, you can try all you want to destroy the natural tribal divisions, but they're just bubbling them under the surface. They continue to bubble under the surface, and they will shoot up again, which they do. Okay, have a good evening, everybody.
Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Best of luck. Yes.
Thank you.